We're in John chapter 11. I missed having Bob around. You in here somewhere? Yeah, you're over there. I missed having you around. It was just not the same without you here. I talked to him earlier in the week, and he said, "Do you think we should get together and practice? We haven't played in a long time." I said, "The only thing we need to practice is you not crying." And he must have, obviously, because he did pretty well, all things considered. I thought he'd be a blubbering mess, so. Speaking of resurrection from the dead, we're in John chapter 11. This is how it starts. It says, "Now a certain man was sick, named Lazarus, of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. It was that Mary which anointed the Lord with ointment, wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Therefore his sister sent unto him, saying, 'Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick.'" Lazarus, it's the Greek form of Eliezer, the Hebrew name, which means God is my help. Lazarus, Mary, Martha. It tells us in verse 2, it was this Mary that anointed the Lord with ointment, wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. John's going to describe that to us in the next chapter. Interesting enough, that same account is in Matthew 26, and it's in Mark chapter 14. And in both of those instances, Matthew and Mark say that Jesus, when she does this, and you know, Judas gives her a hard time about it, because she's wasting money because he's a thief and had his hand in the bag. Jesus has let her alone. You know, wherever the gospel is preached, this will be spoken of as a memorial to her, that this act of worship that she did for Jesus. But even though both of them said that this will be remembered forever, neither of them told us her name. They didn't say who it was. And most likely, remember, John is written a lot later than the other gospels. He was a young man when he was with Christ walking the earth. And he lived to be, you know, tradition says upwards of 100 years old, wrote this a lot later. Early on, when the other ones were written shortly after the events happened, you know, it was at the time when it was illegal to be a Christian in some places. And I'm not surprised that Matthew and Mark would have left the names out just to protect the innocent, you know. But at John's point, I think most of them are all long dead, so he tells us it was Mary. This family has a special relationship with Jesus. It seems like somewhere along the line, the sisters, Mary and Martha, and their brother, Lazarus, opened their hearts to the Lord and ultimately opened their home to him. And this was a safe place for him. You know, Jesus is going to say at one point when someone wants to follow him, "Look, birds have nests, you know, foxes have holes, but the Son of Man doesn't have any place to lay his head. I don't own any property. This isn't my home." In fact, that interesting, when it says the Son of Man doesn't have any way to where to bow his head, the next time that phrase is used, I think the only other time which Jesus said it's used, is when he's on the cross. He says, "It's finished. Father, into my hands I commit your spirit." And then he bowed his head and gave up the ghost. And because this wasn't his home, and it wasn't, that was his home. Well, but this place is a place where he could go. You know, when you've got people thronging you on one hand everywhere you go, and you've got others that are trying to kill you every time you come out into public, it's nice to have a place. It's nice to have a place where you can just let down and relax. And I know for me, one of the things about going through the Gospels, one of the reasons I love to do it, is for a long time I think I labored under the misunderstanding of who Jesus is and what this book is. I always looked at it as a history and maybe an object lesson or a morality tale, but I guess I kind of missed the humanity of it, that these are real people, that they get mad sometimes, they laugh sometimes, they cry sometimes, and that Jesus, it says, was tempted in all points like we are, which means he experienced rejection. We're told that he was anointed with, in the Old Testament, prophesying of him, that he was anointed with the oil of joy above his brethren, and yet he was also more sorrowful than any man. That if there was ever anyone who was bipolar, It would have been Jesus, because he had the highest of the highs and the lowest of the lows. He had people worshiping him as God, and he had people trying to kill him for being a blasphemer. And the things that he says, and of course, as we come to these chapters, some of these stories are very familiar. This one is obviously one of the more famous ones. But it's important to remember, one, these are real people, and two, they haven't read this chapter yet. We've read this chapter. We know the story. Let me blow it for you. Lazarus is going to be raised from the dead. Okay, there. It's out of the bag. So now we can enjoy the story and not be in anticipation of what's going to happen. But remember, none of these people know that. It's never done that. It's never happened before, at least not like this. And it starts out by telling us you've got Mary and Martha and Lazarus, who are friends of Jesus. They consider him a friend. They love him. They have some inkling of who he is. They also like him. And it starts right out by telling us in verse 1 that sickness that will be ultimately followed by death invades the home of someone who is a friend of Jesus. Which means that being a friend of Jesus is not a guarantee that you will not suffer pain and you will not suffer loss and you will not have difficult times. Last time I checked, the statistics was just exactly at 100%. Everybody dies. 10 out of 10 people die. Well, when he gets sick, and apparently this is a sickness that they understand is a bad one, they send to the Lord in verse 3, saying, "Lord, he whom you love is sick." Two really cool things about this verse jump out at me. First of all, the basis in which they approach him. It does not say, "Jesus, the one that loves you is sick." It doesn't say that. It doesn't say, "You need to come because he really loves you. You know, he loves you, so you got to help him." They know Jesus well enough to appeal to him not on their performance, but on his. It's not, "I love you so much, you got to help me." It's, you love him so much. And then that's all they have to say. That's the other thing that jumps out at me. They don't say, "The one that you love is sick, so you need to come here and you need to heal him so he doesn't suffer anymore and he doesn't die." They don't even have to say that. They just have to say, "Jesus, the one that you love is sick," because they know him well enough to know that's all he needs to know, is that someone that he loves is hurting or is in pain, is sick. And they think, if we just tell him that. See, and that's so outside of, unfortunately, my practice too often. There's an interesting passage in Isaiah. And Isaiah is making the point that, you know, there's us and then there's God. Us, God. All right? And he says, and this is kind of a rhetorical question, "Who's directed the Spirit of the Lord? Or being his counselor has taught him? With whom took he counsel, and who instructed him and taught him the path of judgment, taught him knowledge and showed him the way of understanding?" Who's God going to for counsel? Who's actually telling God what it is he needs to do? And I read that and I go, "Oh, me, you need to do this. This is how you need to do it. See, dear Santa Claus, this is my list and I need these things and I need them now. This way, amen. Make it so," right? And instead of treating him like God, who is sovereign, we treat him like the genie in the bottle. And we got three wishes, so if we just rub it in the right way, out he comes, and we just tell him what we want. It's going to be this way, this way, this way, because this is obviously best. Because I know, because I can see the end from the beginning. Oh, wait, I can't, can I? I don't even know what's around the corner. I don't know the next thing that's going to happen. So for me to presume that I know the best thing in any given situation is really just that, presumption. It's arrogance, it's foolishness to think I know better. Because he has a level of perspective that we don't. We are, you know, along with that statistic that 10 out of 10 people die, there are some other realities of life. One is that there is time. Two, that we're trapped in it. You can't go back. You always go forward. You can see back. You can't see forward. We are on a line, and we're traveling in a direction through time, and we lack perspective. Bible tells us that God is outside of time. He sees the end from the beginning. He calls those things that are not as though they are because he knows. It's you know, and one of the best examples that I can think of that I like a lot, I use a lot, is, you know, the Macy's parade. At the front of the parade, you might have the band, and the back of the parade, you've got Underdog. But the Goodyear blimp that is over the top of that sees the whole parade. The people that are standing along the side of the street, they just see the progression. They can see the stuff that's gone by. If they're standing on the corner, they don't see it till it comes around. They don't see what's coming. But the vantage point of outside of that line gives them, gives God the perspective of the whole thing. And so for me to try to tell him what I need to do is really foolish, because I don't know what's coming next, but he does. And he knows all of the variables and all of the inputs. Well, they come to him and they don't bother to try to instruct him. They just say, the one that you love is sick. And when Jesus heard that, he said, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby. Now, he's a ways away from where they are. Truth is, if the timing is right, he's, by the time the guy gets there to tell him, he's probably already dead. All right? But Jesus says, and we'll cover this in a little more detail because of some other things he's going to say in a minute. Oh, yeah. This isn't to death. It's okay. He's sick, but this is not unto death. It's for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified. Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. And when he had heard, therefore, that he was sick, he took off as fast as he could, and he ran in his robes. He pulled them up, and he just got those sandals cooking. It doesn't say anything like that. I don't like reading verses like this. He loves them. He heard that he was sick. So he hung around for a couple days before he bothered to start going there. That's not what I like to hear. I like to think, you know, it's my time. Come on, come on, come on, right? No. Because there's a bigger purpose to this. Besides that, he's already dead. He abode 2 days still in the same place where he was. Then after that, he says to his disciples, let's go into Judea again. Now, he could have, understand, any of these things that he does them in a particular way for a particular reason. Sometimes, some of the miracles, like with the guy who was blind and he makes the mud, spits in the ground, makes the mud, smears it in his eyes, tells him to go wash. I think he does that just to tick off the religious folk, which I like that. That's another reason I like reading the gospel, because he doesn't like religious folk. He just likes people who love him. So he does things. He does things for a reason. He could have healed them remotely. He could have done it from a distance. He didn't even need them to come tell him that he was sick. He is God, after all. You know? But instead, he let this play out the way it is. He decided to go there personally for a particular reason. His disciples say, Master, you know, the Jews of late, and I love the King James the way it meant, the Jews of late sought to stone thee, and goest thou thither again. No, what they're saying is, they're still trying to kill you. You know, last time we were there, they all had rocks. They were going to kill you. We were with you, which means they'd kill us too. You sure you really want to go back there? Because they want to kill you. I don't know if you noticed that last time. I mean, we managed somehow to get away. I don't know how that worked. You were just there. They picked up rocks, and then we just walked away, and I kept expecting one in the back of the head, but it didn't happen. But you sure you want to go back? Because that might not happen again. I mean, they're going to kill us. Do you know they want to kill us? And they're instructing him because, you know, God needs our instruction again. And Jesus answered, aren't there 12 hours in a day? If any man walk in the day, he stumbles not, because he sees the light of this world. But if a man walk in the night, he stumbles because there's no light in him. He had said back in chapter 8, I am the light of the world. He that follows me shall not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. You know, there is a time of working. And he's also making the point there and here that while he's here, he has a job to do. And during the day, when the light is in our presence, when he's with us, there's certain things that I'm here to do. And every time they grab rocks, and of course the gospel writers would write it later on, they took up stones to kill him, but his time had not yet come. So he just walked out. Because he, walking in the path of God, doing the work of God, was bulletproof until his time was done. You and I, if we are walking in the plan of God, doing the work of God, are bulletproof until our time is done. Does that mean I could go, you know, jump into traffic? I could. It would be the indication that my time was done. But truthfully, we don't have to sweat all of the details. I mean, certainly, you know, wear your seatbelt, right? Because click it or ticket, it's the law. But you don't have to worry. You don't have to worry. You can get caught up in worry. I can get caught up in worry and worrying about all the details and what if this and how about that. Jesus says, nah, it's day. It's still my time to work. These things said he, and after that he said unto them, Our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I go that I may wake him out of sleep. Then said his disciples, Lord, if he's asleep, well, he'll do well. Oh, he's resting? That's a good sign. He must be getting better. He's sleeping. Oh, I'm glad to hear that he's sleeping. Phew, that makes me feel better, because we were kind of worried. You know, they said he was on the point of death, and you were like just dragging your feet. But now to hear you say that he's asleep, oh, that's comforting. Howbeit, verse 13, Jesus spoke of his death, but they thought that he'd spoken of taking a rest in sleep. And again, I like this because these are the apostles, right? This isn't even the B team. This is the guys that he picks to change the world. Imagine that. You got three and a half years. You've come to reveal yourself, to die for the sins of the world, and then to instill an understanding and a knowledge in a dozen guys to affect the rest of humanity. And these are the guys you pick. And you're a couple, you know, weeks or maybe a couple months away from being crucified, the end of that 3 years, and you're saying something about him sleeping, and they're going, oh, good, he's getting better. And then finally, Jesus said unto them plainly, no, Lazarus is dead. Interesting, he's asleep. Matthew chapter 9, when there's a guy named Jairus who comes to Jesus. His 12-year-old daughter is at the point of death, and he's desperate, and he goes to him and says, you got to come. My daughter's, she's sick. And by the time they get there, she's already died. The professional mourners in that culture have shown up, and they're all, you know, they're all wailing and doing the thing. And Jesus walks into the house, and he says, oh, she's not dead. She's just asleep. And those professionals who are being paid to mourn go, you're kidding me. She's dead. I'm a professional. This is my third one today. I know a dead girl. That's a dead girl. And they go from wailing to laughing in a moment. But for Jesus, he's like, no. And then he just goes up to her, says, little lamb, arise, and she wakes up. Because for Jesus, death is just sleep. For you and I, death should be just sleep. It's temporary. It changes everything when you think of it as sleep versus as death. Because death is, ultimately, it's what? The pain of death comes from separation, right? Because when someone that we love dies, we recognize, I'm not going to be talking to them. I may talk to them and say words to them, but they're not going to respond. I'm not going to be able to hug them. I'm not going to be able to hold their hand. And that, you know, going to a funeral is always weird, and seeing someone who has died. And I pray, you know, any of you who, if you're still around when I die, shut the box, all right? Dig back. If you have to go back to high school, that's okay. Find a decent picture. I don't care. Whatever. Find me playing basketball. Well, he didn't look like that when I knew him. No, but that was the best we got, so we went for it. But whatever. But, you know, I don't want people to remember me necessarily that way. I remember being at a funeral as a kid, and the whole time I'm just looking, because I swear I see that chest going up and down, right? It's just something about your eyes. No, they're going to get up. And then you go up, and everyone else is mourning, and all of you just wants to touch that hand to see, you know? But you don't want to do it, but you want to do it. And it seems like a permanent thing, but it isn't for us. You know, in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, Paul writes a letter to the church at Thessalonica, and they're all bummed out because some of them have died, and they're expecting, because Paul, he was only there 3 weeks. Imagine this. You start a church from people who know nothing about anything. Nothing. They didn't grow up in a religion and then get saved. They didn't grow up in Judaism. I mean, these are people who know nothing about anything. You come, you preach the gospel, they receive it. You got 3 weeks, and then you run out of town. So you've got 3 weeks to instill in them everything they need to know about being a believer. What would you focus on if you felt like, I got 3 weeks to bring somebody up in the faith, and then that's it? What would you talk to them about? What would be the thing you'd really like emphasize that you know they need to know? For Paul, it was the return of Christ. And when he writes the letter to them, it's because they were all bummed out because some of them have died, and they believe that they've missed the resurrection, the return of Christ, because they expected him to come any minute. So he had taught them about the return of Christ. In 3 weeks, that was one of the things he focused on, because why? It's the blessed hope of the church. It should be the thing that carries us on, that this is not my home, and this is not all there is, and that we have something waiting for us, that he's going to come back and take us home. That should be driving us, motivating us. Well, he writes this letter to correct them because they were all upset because people had died and they thought they missed it. And he says, but I would not have you ignorant, brethren, concerning them which were asleep, that you sorrow not, even as others which have no hope. Look, the rest of the world is sorrowing with no hope because they think they'll never see him again. You shouldn't be that way, because they're just asleep. He says, for if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so them which sleep in Jesus will God bring with him. For this we say unto you by the word of the Lord, that we which are alive and remain unto the coming of the Lord, we won't prevent or go before them which are asleep. The Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, the voice of the archangel, the trump of God. The dead in Christ shall rise first, and then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them into the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so shall we ever be with the Lord. Wherefore, comfort one another with these words. That should be a comfort for us, that the people that we love that have passed, we'll see again, and not in some floaty, mystical, I'm just a ghost and we'll just kind of drift through each other, but I'm going to get to hug my dad. I'm going to get a kiss from my grandmother. I look forward to those things. That this is not the end. They're just asleep. Well, he tells them, no, plainly, Lazarus is dead. And he says, I'm glad for your sakes that I was not there, to the intent that you may believe. Nevertheless, let us go unto him. I'm glad just for your sake, because this is going to be meaningful for you. Then said Thomas, which is called Didymus, and that's Greek for the twin. Thomas is a twin. Interesting, some people think that they called him the twin. You know how guys are when they hang out. They all have nicknames, right? I mean, you just can't call each other by the name. That would be wrong. You got to make some kind of nickname. Thomas was the twin. It could be that he had a twin brother somewhere. Could be. Some scholars believe it's because he looked a lot like Jesus, and so they called him the twin, which would make sense, actually, in terms of this verse. Because remember, they just said, you sure you want to go back there? Because they want to kill us, right? They're going to kill you. And Thomas is thinking, great, because I look like you. That's great. I like to look like the one that everybody wants to kill. And he says to his fellow disciples, great, let's go also. We'll die with him. And I read that, and I don't know. Is this Thomas like actually showing a bunch of faith and like, I don't care, I'm with you, Jesus? Maybe. You know, I mean, you got to feel for him. He goes down in history known with, what's his nickname for the rest of eternity? Doubting Thomas. One time, you miss church, one time you don't show up, rest of your life, you're branded, Doubting Thomas. I don't know. He's willing to go. Then when Jesus came, he found that he'd lain in the grave 4 days already. That's kind of significant, 4 days. The Hebrew tradition was that the soul would kind of hang around the body for 3 days. But then it was gone after 3 days, because after 3 days, there'd been enough decomposition that it was not even hardly recognizable. It says, now Bethany was nigh unto Jerusalem, about King James 15 furlongs off. Anybody know how many furlongs in a mile? Anybody know how many furlongs in a mile? Good, you guys don't go to the track. That's a good thing. It's about eight. It's an eighth of a mile, a furlong. So they're around 2 miles away. And many of the Jews came to Martha and Mary to comfort them concerning their brother. Then Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went and met him. But Mary still sat in the house. Then said Martha unto Jesus, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother had not died. Now, this is one of those instances where you read this, and I read this, and I have to ask myself, what was the tone, right? Because this is like a text message. And, you know, texts are dangerous. I mean, it's a fun little tool, but, man, don't communicate anything important other than, you know, fire or something, you know, whatever. But because you just, there's so many ways you can... You know, when we try to make it better, we use those little emoticons, the little smileys, LOL, you know, the smiley face or the big grinny face or some of the other ones that you guys put on your messages. I don't know what her tone is here. Is this, if you'd been here, my brother wouldn't have died. That's the tone I expect out of Mary. Martha's the Martha, working all the time. I just kind of picture Martha as more of a, if you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died. But, you know, I can't say that for sure. And her brother just died. So you know what? If that's what her tone is, give her a break. Her brother just died. You have to give some grace to people when they're going through emotional stuff. Sometimes they say things that they don't mean. And She says, if you'd been here, my brother had not died. And then she says this, but I know that even now, whatsoever you will ask of God, God will give it to you. Does she really think that he's going to raise her brother from the dead? He's been dead for 4 days. I don't think so, to be honest with you. I don't think this is what this is. Because the next verse, look what he says. Jesus says to her, your brother will rise again. And Martha says to him, I know that he shall rise again in the resurrection at the last day. She's not expecting. He's been dead 4 days. I mean, it's one thing. Resuscitation was understandable. Obviously, they didn't have the medical technology we have. But we've watched so many movies, and we know what it's like. We thoroughly expect that just because somebody's dead doesn't mean anything. You know, get out the paddles, clear, you know, and back they come again. We'll just resuscitate them, right? Do a little mouth-to-mouth. You know, whatever, how many the count is, I forget. It's been a long time since I went through life-saving course. But that's shortly after death. That's not 4 days after death. It's been 4 days. 4 days, no embalming in that culture. No air conditioning, no refrigeration. When you die, when your blood stops circulating and your heart stops, within about 4 minutes, the decay begins. The blood stops circulating, and then it settles. It's in a bunch of tubes, and if there's nothing pushing the pressure, it just all settles to the bottom. And eventually, the heavier particulates in the blood will sink down. And that's why, if you've ever seen a dead body that's been laying for a while, they'll be all bruised and black on the back because all the blood will sink down to where the lower parts of the body. The cells will rupture because a lot of the acids and stuff they produce for digesting food and whatever else in you will start to digest them. The bacteria, the helpful little critters that live inside of all of us to help us digest our food will start working on us. And then you're in the Middle East, no refrigeration, there's flies. The flies have a way of finding stuff. What they did, that's why they bury you quick in that culture. They would wash the body. It used to be in that culture for a long time, they really got big into dressing people up and putting on their best finery and all that. But then really with Gamaliel, history tells us it was Gamaliel, a teacher who we'll hear him in a minute saying some things, but the one that Paul sat at his feet and learned from, he really started this whole movement of, you know what, we came in naked, let's just go out simply. And because of his influence, they went to just putting on like a really simple white article of clothing. They would wrap them, they would tie the hands, the legs together, they would put that thing around the jaw because, you know, you die and the mouth goes open, so they would put that cloth around there, and then they'd do one long sheet that was underneath you and went around the top, and they'd kind of tie that off. They'd put some herbs and they'd put like strong smelling stuff around you to try to keep the smell down as long as possible. They'd bring you into a cave where they would have carved out some bed places, and they would lay your body in there, and then they'd seal it up. After a year or two, when decay had done its job, you'd be down to bones, and they would go back into the tomb, and they would scrape the bones into an ossuary, which is a bone box. We still find some of those today. And they'd put the bones in there, and they'd use the ledge for the next family member that died. So they get you in the ground quick, because Middle Eastern heat, you leave meat out, you know what happens. And so he'd been dead 4 days. His internal organs had dissolved. His eyes had dissolved and sunk in. His blood had all separated. Rigor mortis had set in, you know, where everything tightens up, but then it probably loosened again. The gases are working. He's probably bloated. I mean, and it gets the gases inside of you. If they don't release, then they'll blow, you know, and you can just, I mean, so enjoy dinner. I hear there's a buffet today, a wing one. But I tell you this because she's not expecting this. I think when she says, I know that even now, whatsoever you will ask of God, God will give it to you. This is her way of saying, I've wrestled through the difficult thing of you not meeting my expectations, and I still trust you. I still know you are who you say you are. I don't know why you didn't do what I thought you should have done. I don't know why you didn't save somebody that you loved. But I still believe you are who you say you are, and I just have to fall back on the fact that you know best. Because sometimes you come into life into hard things and you have to decide, is this going to be the thing that moves me or not? Ultimately, you will be disappointed as a Christian because God is not going to move in the way you think he needs to move in some situation. And then you have to decide. And you know, Jesus, look, when he said he had all these people following him for the wrong reason, and he turns around and says, hey, if you don't eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no part with me. And the crowd goes, ew, that's just gross, you know. And he doesn't explain, no, I'm talking about communion. That's metaphorical. No, I don't mean that. Don't leave. He says something hard and he watches them go. And then he turns to the disciples because they're all saying, man, this is a hard saying. And he says, you going too? And then Peter says, where else are we going to go? You alone have the words of life. Peter had the attitude, I know who you are. Even if I don't understand you, I know who you are. And I trust that. Well, I think that's what Martha's saying. I trust you. I know you can. I don't believe that you're not. I haven't lost faith in you. I just don't understand. And he says, your brother will rise again. And she says, you know, I know he'll rise again in the resurrection of the last day. The concept of heaven, hell, death, kind of misty in the Old Testament. There are a lot of verses that talk about people sleeping in the grave. Some people get the idea of just soul sleep from that. But there are some that talk about resurrection. Job says, I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he'll stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, yet in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold, and not another. Daniel says, many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to everlasting contempt. Same word, everlasting. If there is everlasting life, according to Daniel, there's also everlasting punishment. Same word. You can't have one without the other. So there is an idea of everlasting. There is the idea of a resurrection. She says, I know, yeah, in the last day. And he says, no, you don't know. In verse 25, I am the resurrection and the life. He that believes in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Believest thou this? I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will never die. Well, wait a minute. Lazarus is dead and he believed in you. Again, no, he's asleep. He's not dead. He's just asleep. Is a verse that always troubled me a little bit in Luke 21. Verse 17 of Luke 21 says, you'll be hated of all men for my name's sake, but there shall not a hair of your head perish. And your patience possess your souls. I like that. That's a good note, but not a hairy head will perish. But if you read the verse right before that, you shall be betrayed both by parents and brethren, kinsfolk and friends, and some of you they'll cause to be put to death. Wait a minute. What does that mean? Well, it means the death of the body is not anything like the death of the soul. Very two different things. One is eternal, the other is temporary. One is sleep, the other is permanent. He says, you know, yeah, they might wreck your body, but you won't perish. You'll have everlasting life. And he's saying, I am the resurrection and the life. She says to him, yeah, Lord, I believe that you're the Christ, the Son of God, which should come into the world. And when she'd said so said, she went her way. She called Mary, her sister, secretly, saying, the Master's come, and he calls for you. And as soon as she heard that, she arose quickly, and she came to him. Now, Jesus was not yet come into the town, but was in that place where Martha had met him. The Jews then, which were with her in the house and comforted her, when they saw Mary, that she rose up and hastily went out, they followed her, saying, she goes to the grave to weep there. And when Mary was come where Jesus was and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying unto him, Lord, if you had been there, my brother had not died. Those words sound familiar? Sister said the exact same thing. Again, I don't know if the tone is the same. But isn't it interesting? They both lost a brother. They both went through a hard time. And they both say the exact same thing to God. If you'd been here, he wouldn't have died. Which tells me they talked about this a lot. Because they both were like, where's Jesus? Where was Jesus in all of this? Why? Well, if he had been here, he wouldn't have died. Well, if he hadn't been here. And what you find, and I think this is just a good general reminder for all of us, the people that you spend time with, you'll sound like, okay? You come, just listen to your kids sometime You know, I mentioned before, I had Sarah's daughter over for a birthday party a while ago, and every time I was in the living room, I thought Sarah was sitting at my kitchen table, because Callie sounds just like her. When she's got the same reflection of speech and stuff, same manner. You talk like the people that you're around. I had certain friends that I hung with that would raise me up, and then I had certain friends that I hung with that would drag me down. My mother would tend to send me towards one group and pull me away from the others. Their parents probably all said, stay away from that brown kid, he's nothing but trouble. Same words, if you'd been here. When Jesus saw her weeping, I'm sure her tone was, Lord, if you'd been here. And the Jews also weeping, which came with her, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled. Now, King James, if you just read that, you'd think, oh, he saw them crying, and then he got all misty, and it just lost it. That word's angry. It's the word that's used of a horse that goes, pah, pah, you know, when it gets mad and it's ready to, like, the war horse. I mean, that's kind of what it is. And that's Jesus' attitude, all right? Because here's somebody that he loves, and she's wrecked, for no good reason. She's suffering because someone has died, and someone died because of sin. In fact, everyone dies because of sin. Because all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. But sin and death entered through one man. There was one choice that was made that affected us all. And he's ticked. This makes him angry. And he said, where have you laid him? And they said, Lord, come and see. And then he's also compassionate. He gets angry at death, but then he weeps. Now, why is he weeping? Is he weeping for Lazarus? No, he knows what he's going to do. He just said before he left with the guys, hey, I'm glad this happened because you're going to see the glory of God. It's going to glorify the Son of God. What's going to happen? He knew what he was going to do. He's not mad about not seeing Lazarus because Lazarus is going to be coming out in just a couple minutes. He's weeping because of the effect of sin and death on the people that he loves. And the Jews said, behold how he loved him. Well, yes, he did, but that's not why he's weeping. And some of them said, could not this man which had opened the eyes of the blind have caused even that this man should not have died? I mean, but now it's too late, right? Because, I mean, it's been 4 days. Jesus, therefore, again, groaning. Back to the angry word again. You ever been that way? You're mad, then you cry a bit, then you get mad again. That's where he is. He gets mad, and he comes to the grave, and it was a cave, and a stone lay upon it. They would put him in there, roll the stone up there for two reasons. One, keep the smell out, or keep the smell in. Two, keep the critters out, you know. And he said, take away the stone. And Martha, the sister of him that was dead, said unto him, Lord, by this time he stinketh, for he's been dead 4 days. They must figure Jesus just wants to, like, see him himself or something. I need to see the body for closure. That's what it is. I need closure. No, I need openature. That's what I need. Open the thing. Lord, he stinketh. And Jesus says to her, said I not unto thee that if you would believe, you'd see the glory of God? And they took away the stone. Now, just out of curiosity, whose faith is it that raises Lazarus from the dead? Is it Lazarus's? No, he's asleep and dead. No faith exercise. Was it Mary and Martha? Lord, if you've been here, I know he'll come back in the last day, but Lord, don't roll away the stone. He stinks. There's no faith on their part. The only faith that's involved is the faith of Christ, right? So, if you pray for something and it doesn't happen, and someone lays a trip on you that you just didn't have enough faith, smack them. No, pray for them, but don't take it to heart. Because the truth is, Lazarus didn't exercise any faith. In fact, you had the one example where the guy was paralyzing on a bed, and his friends dig a hole in the roof because the place is just mobbed and Jesus is inside in a Bible study and they lower him down. And the guy on the bed's like, get me out of here. No, we don't have to do this. And his buddies are like, no, you're going down there to see Jesus. I don't care what happens. And it says Jesus looks up and he sees their faith. It's not the guy who's laying on the bed. It's his friend. So if you ever have a friend who says you weren't healed because you didn't exercise enough faith, take him to that passage and say, well, where's your faith, dude? Because his friends had enough faith to get him healed. What's the problem? You know, you need to work. No. I mean, it's stupid. It's Jesus' faith. It's not your faith. It's the object of your faith. It is Christ. And they took away the stone from where the dead was laid, and Jesus lifted up his eyes, and he said, Father, I thank you that you've heard me. And I know that you hear me always, but because of the people which stand by, I said it, that they may believe that you've sent me. Lord, thank you that you've heard me. I'm praying out loud right now. I know you hear me. It's for them, so that they know that I actually prayed, you know, and that this is coming from you. And when he'd thus spoken, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. Not a rainbow and a happy thought somewhere. Come back and be Lazarus again. No, he's Lazarus. He was Lazarus when he died. He was Lazarus wherever he went after he died. It's Lazarus when he comes back. You are who you are. You don't get born again as somebody else. You are who you are. It's appointed unto man once unto die. There's no endless cycle of reincarnation and new beings. And I remember past life. Sorry. Lazarus, come back. And when he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes, his face was bound about with a napkin, Jesus said unto them, loose him and let him go. He comes out doing the penguin walk because he's still tied up and his mouth is tied with a cloth. Interesting, if you just want to look at it from a kind of a metaphor spiritual thing here, he's been resurrected. Is an act of recreation has happened, which again, because some people, when they talk about, you know, death, well, what should we do when we die? Do they bury us? What about cremation? Is that wrong for a believer? Someone was telling me the other day, was it you? Someone was telling me the other day about a big article in the paper about liquefaction now. There's some chemical process they do where they turn you basically into soup and it happens real quick. Some people, oh, you can't do that. Where will the body be? Well, you know what? Have you seen one that's 100 years old? I mean, most of them, just the fire or the chemicals do what the earth does just a lot quicker, you know? But the cool thing is he's already partially dissolved, but he must have the blueprint, right? Because he just remakes him. That's the nice thing about DNA. Everyone's got blueprint. We'll just make another one. So they bring him back to life. So from a spiritual metaphorical thing, he's been resurrected, but what's he still got all over him? The trappings of death, right? Does it still stink? Because he stank. Okay, but now he's been resurrected. Have the grave clothes been like magically cleaned? Or do they still smell like they've been wrapping dead meat for 4 days? I'm guessing that's probably part of it. Because when I look at it from a spiritual sense, someone can hear the gospel, they can respond to the gospel, they can be born again, but you still got a lot of dead smelling stuff in your life that needs to be removed. Doesn't mean you're not resurrected. And Jesus could have gone, halakazam, and poof, he's in a fresh new robe. But he doesn't do that. He tells his friends, go help him get clean, right? Go help him get loosed from the stuff that's still binding him that smells like his old life and death. I think that's part of our responsibility too. And then I'll just read these last two verses. Many of the Jews which came to Mary and had seen the things which Jesus did believed on him. You think? I think you would have, right? You'd have thought somebody raised from the dead, everybody's believing that, right? No, because look at the next verse. But some of them went their way to the Pharisees and they told. Some of them went and tattled. Some believed, and then some went their own way. You remember the other story, the other Lazarus in the Gospels back in Luke chapter 16, where there's a rich guy and a beggar named Lazarus who die at the same time, and one goes to eternal suffering, the rich guy who was all selfish, and then Lazarus is in a place of eternal comfort. And the rich guy is talking, and he's like, you need to warn my brothers that they don't come to this place. They can't come where I am because it's tortured. Send Lazarus back. And he's talking to Abraham, and Abraham's like, no, they have the Bible, they have the law and the prophets, they have the Old Testament. That's enough. And this guy in torment says, no, no, no. But if someone would raise from the dead and go back, they'd believe. And Abraham says, no. Because if they won't believe the law and the prophets, they won't believe if someone raises from the dead. And here you've got people, same sight, same information, same opportunity. Some believe, some go their own way. You and I have the same choice. We have the same choice to offer. He rose from the dead. We'll talk about it next week because it's Easter Sunday. Surprise, surprise. Let me encourage you with this. This is not all there is. This is not the end. This is staging ground for eternity. We are eternal beings in temporary bodies. I was saying, Bobby, let's leave with a song. I'm waiting 16 weeks for you to come back. Play this. 17 weeks, whatever, it all runs together.